This is disc number 4.
2,000 feet up. Madness, Zeke. Pure madness.
I know it, Doc. And you're slick-heeled. Hope that Cremello of yours is clear-footed.
Don't worry. She may be light in the timber, but she's lady-broke and she's got bottom.
Ezekiel spurred his horse on and the riders began to climb.
30. They followed the burrow trail up the slope, snow clinging to their slickers and greatcoats and hats and the horses and rigs and rifle butt plates and every other conceivable surface, until they resembled a trio of ghosts conjured up out of the snow. Ezekiel rode point, holding his saddle horn, head lowered to the storm. The other men didn't see it, but he smiled, even more immersed in the moment than when he'd emerged onto the roof of Emerald House several hours prior and witnessed the slaughter that had occurred there. This last year, he'd existed in a state of numbness so complete it felt like living death. In bed with Gloria, it would often be well past midnight, occasionally dawn, before he drifted into sleep. So intense were the memories of those exuberant, passionate, bloody Leadville years. His mind blazing back at full bore, trying to unblur the faces, invoke the familiar voices, and tears coming when he did, because they brought with them the fleeting sensation of freedom, and his old swagger, and the limitless potential every morning had once afforded him. He'd never lain in bed in Leadville, obsessing on the past. It had always been vivid, rushing present. Fuck even the future. One night he'd recall a week spent specking with the boys near Crested Butte. Another, the rowdy, drunken revelry of a 4th of July celebration. Then he'd imagine himself sitting at a corner table in some bucket of blood, 3 in the morning, brimming with whiskey as the calico queens hung on his shoulders, watching the paling demeanors of his opponents on the final hand, when he pushed forward his pair of nickel-plated Smith & Wesson revolvers with their mother-of-pearl grips, upping the pot for the flush he held. Sometimes he'd just lie there retrieving faces. Whores he'd felt tender toward, men he'd fought, men he'd loved, killed, buried, savoring them all, every face, repressed scent, lost sound, with a sweet and piercing nostalgia. Gus, especially Gus, kept him up nights. Ezekiel's lips moving in the dark as he spoke for both of them. Father-son conversations about God and love, guns and horses. Once Gloria had woken, asked, "Who you talking to, baby?" And he lied, told her he must have been whispering in his sleep. He loved his wife beyond words, but Gus, only Gus, had filled that vacancy, destroyed the angry, restless boredom left in the wake of his outlaw days. But this Christmas, with his head bowed as the sky hemorrhaged snow, his mind blissfully attended to the present, to keeping his horse on the mountain, to listening for slides over the sounds of wind and snow pelting the leather of his hat, and how his feet had grown cold in the calfskin-lined cowhide boots, and what it would feel like to draw a bead on Otha and Billy, see what they'd stolen from Bart. Ezekiel was as happy as he'd been in years. He felt like the true translation of himself again. An hour into the climb, they stopped to let the horses blow.
"How close you reckon we are?" Russell asked.
Ezekiel shook his head. He had no way of knowing for certain, since after 30 yards in either direction, the trail disappeared into mist. They pushed on again, the horses panting and snorting, pausing every few steps. Then the slope began to level out. Ezekiel found that he didn't have to lean forward as much, and the horses quickened their gait. He finally halted his gelding, and the others came up beside him on his left. The doc and the preacher still engrossed in the discussion they'd been having for the last 400 vertical feet.
"I'm not saying you sull around, but you do strike me as a melancholic these days," Russell said. "Are you Domsey?"
"I'd not deny it."
"You sleeping peacefully?"
"Not often. My mind tends to race in the silence, and I don't know how to shut it off. I have these terrible headaches."
Ezekiel studied the distance. His back ached. The burrow tracks continued on as far as he could see, which wasn't far in the blizzard. He suspected the pass lay just ahead.
"Do you ever experience desperate thoughts?"
the doctor asked. "Desperate? You mean like ending myself prematurely?"
"Well, that's exactly what I mean."
"It's a grave sin, Russ."
Well, I'm aware. Don't mean it ain't afflicting you.
I have, on occasion, considered it.
Recently?
Last night.
At this elevation, no trees could thrive, but glancing up ahead, Ezekiel discerned a badlands. Vague profiles of rock formations and a small boulder field drenched in snow and looming like a herd of Gothic monoliths. He turned to his compatriots. Their conversation embarrassed him, a subject he felt uncomfortable being made privy to, though that wasn't his reason for interrupting. It was merely to advise the doc to slide his big 50 out of the rifle scabbard and keep on the eye in case they were dry-gulched. Russell said,
You should come by my office, Stephen. Let me examine you. Your gums have a blue tinge. Absent a full evaluation, I can't say for sure, but it could be lead...
Doc, I'm sorry to break up your conversation, but...
The ball made a loud crunch as it entered Russell Ilg's head through his left eye, taking a large shard of his skull with it on the way out. Then came the thunderous boom that Ezekiel recognized as a big bore six-gun. The lead ball had knocked Russell from the horse, but his stovepipe boots had caught up in the stirrups so that he hung upside down, the contents of his skull dropping into the snow as his horse dragged him back down the slope. Ezekiel dismounted. The snow rose to his waist. He grabbed the Winchester, yelled at Stephen as another report spooked the horses.
Get off of there, man! You want to get killed?
But the preacher sat stone-faced and frozen in the saddle, staring through falling snow at the two figures darting through the boulder field. Ezekiel pulled Stephen's boots out of the stirrups and knocked him off his mount into the snow.
Get back down the slope and stay hid. Take Doc's rifle if you want and keep your head down.
A shotgun blasted and Ezekiel's horse boiled over, neighing and rearing up on its hindquarters before collapsing. He crouched in the snow, eyes peeking over the surface as the preacher crawled away, weeping. Ezekiel scrambled from his dying horse. After 30 feet, he stopped, gulped down several lungfuls of thin air. He cocked the lever of the carbine, sat up, sighted a rock outcropping 40 yards upslope that he suddenly realized was the pass, torn white ribbons of cloud streaming over it, driving the snow sideways, making it impossible to see anything distinctly. A lead ball zinged past his right ear. He swung his rifle around, sighted the left edge of a small boulder 50 yards away, and pulled the trigger on a vaquero hat that had peered around the corner. It disappeared, and he cocked the carbine again and clambered to his feet, now fighting toward the boulder field through chest-high drifts, smiling and swelling with all the murderous joy of a boy playing war. 31. Ezekiel walked into the boulder field and hunkered down at the base of a broken pitch of rock. He reached into his slicker and pulled out the box of 44-40s from an inner pocket of his sack coat, tore it open, and slid 5 cartridges into the loading gate. With the wind subsided and his horse no longer braying, what struck him now was the silence. His senses heightened, everything distilled. The smell of wet rock and gunpowder. The sound of snow falling on his hat. His heart thumping like it meant to bust out of his chest, burning cold spreading through the left side of his face. He heard distant whispering, got to his feet, stepped out from behind the rock formation. What lay before him on the gentle downslope reminded Ezekiel of a snowy labyrinth, countless boulders of varying size, some no bigger than a barrel, others rivaling wagons and cabins, bunched together in spots, spaced out in others, and a million places to hide. For a fact, Otha and Billy had deadwood. 20 feet ahead, he spotted what he'd been looking for, tracks in the otherwise smooth, unbroken snow. He waded through the powder, lightheaded. After 3 strides, he froze. From behind a table-topped boulder came an exhalation. He brought the carbine's butt plate flush against his shoulder as something edged out from the rock. He nearly shot a raw-boned burrow with missing ear tips, buried to its neck and laden with an empty cantilla. It stood watching him through large, dull eyes. He moved on through the boulder field. It had stopped snowing, and that seemed to magnify the silence. He came to the tracks. 2 sets. The snow so deep he had to squat down to find which direction the boot prints pointed. Now pushing forward again with what he knew was deluded confidence. Behind any one of the hundreds of rocks, they were laying for him. and this would all be decided by dumb luck. Who saw who first? The sound of a block of snow calving off a boulder drew his attention, and when he turned back to the tracks, a slouch hat poked out of the snow 30 feet ahead. The carbine bucked against his shoulder, and he lunged behind the nearest rock as a shotgun exploded the silence. The shooter had disappeared when he peeked around the corner, Ezekiel figuring he'd ducked back under the snow to reload. He sighted the spot where he'd seen the hat. Had there been only one, he'd have felt at ease staying indefinitely, pinning the man down, waiting for him to lift his head again. But the prospect of a standoff made him nervous with two men in play. As he debated what to do, he heard the unmistakable snick. Perhaps 5 yards behind and a little to the left. Thought he was dead. No sound like the hammer of a 6-gun going back.
You go on and throw that rifle away.
Ezekiel remained crouched in the snow, leaning against the rock.
Swear to God, I got a bead drawed on the back of your head.
All right. But Ezekiel didn't throw his carbine aside. He kept a firm grip on the fore-end stock, a finger in the trigger guard, and turned slowly until he faced the boy standing waist-deep in snow. Ezekiel had hoped to see the revolver trembling in Billy's hand, but the enormous Walker Colt was steady and leveled on his chest like a small cannon.
"That was some shooting back there," Ezekiel said. "Headshot from what? 50, 60 yards? "Told you, throw that artillery down!"
Billy's face twitched as if someone had placed hooks in the left corner of his mouth and was yanking them with a string. Ezekiel found the boy's eyes, didn't like the jitteriness he saw, would have preferred 2 rounds of ice. At least you saw it coming that way.
"We're neighbors, Billy. Our wives are friends."
As he spoke, Ezekiel let the carbine's barrel ease down. Another few inches, he'd take the boy's head off.
"You got a nice family in Bessie and Harriet, and I believe that shot that killed the doc was an accident. Now, I can't speak for your partner, but your bark ain't this hard." "Well, Mr. Curtis, guess you don't know me so good after all."
32. When Otha Wallace arrived, Ezekiel was leaning back on a small shelf in the rock. He'd pulled off his fleece-lined gloves and unbuttoned his slicker and sack coat and vest, unclipped his suspenders, torn open the muslin shirt.
"Where's his rifle?"
"Somewhere in the snow yonder."
"He ain't got a sleeve gun, do he?"
"No, I checked."
Otha stared at Ezekiel.
"He's gut shot."
"I tried to shoot him in the head, but..."
"No, that's fine, Billy. His horns is clipped. Lead ball from a Walker in the bread wallet. Hell of a thing. Caught a case of the slow, didn't you, old Buscadero?"
Ezekiel watched the streaming black blood leak through his fingers as he tried to put back the gray tube of gut that kept pushing out. He could feel blood running down his legs and into his boots. Some had streamed down the rock and melted a burgundy hole in the snow. He looked up at Otha, at the boy who'd sent him on his sunset trail, and when he spoke, his voice came broken and strained by ragged exhalations.
"Bushwhacking, huh? So that's how you operate."
"Whatever gets it done," Otha said.
"How much y'all come away with?"
"There's 69 bricks, 22 pounds apiece."
"But you done the math."
"Sure I done it. Just over 500,000.
Ezekiel nodded.
"Maybe you can buy this boy a new gun. That Walker must be 40 years old.
Otha grinned.
"And some clothes, too."
Billy blushed. Too poor to afford a great coat or a slicker, when he ventured out into winter conditions, his only recourse was to clothe himself in every ratty, moth-eaten garment he owned. So his ensemble comprised layer upon layer of old shirts, threadbare hand-me-down sack coats 2 decades old, and a blue frock coat that had barely survived a house fire back in Tennessee, and still bore the black-fringed, fire-eaten holes to prove it. Ezekiel looked at Billy.
"You've broke your wife's heart, son."
"Ain't ye, son. I want his justin's, Otha. My feet are cold."
We'll discuss the man's plunder in a bit. You got even a jot of decency in you, boy?
Ezekiel moaned.
God damn! Hurt as bad as they say?
Otha asked.
They wasn't building a high line.
A dense cloud had blown over the pass and begun its rolling descent through the boulder field.
You want to go on and tell me, then?
Ezekiel said.
Don't see what you got to lose now. Tell you what. I know my brother left Silverton with you back in the fall. He wired me before he left. I know it was you, Nathan, and two other men. Then you come into a band and 3 weeks later all by yourself saying they decided not to go last minute. And you call me a black liar. And I stand by that claim. Christ!
Ezekiel winced. Otha tossed his double-barreled hammer shotgun to Billy, waded toward Ezekiel, and knelt before him in the snow.
Nathan was your brother. My little brother. What the hell? Don't matter much now, does it? I didn't want to ride with them, but they caught up to me on the trail to abandon in early October. It was for you? That's right. Started snow in the second afternoon, and it didn't stop for a week. We'd only packed provisions for 3 days of travel, and we was hungry by the time the snow quit. Didn't have no webs, 10 miles from anywhere. 6 feet of powder on the ground. Imagine trying to walk any considerable distance in this shit. We tried to hunt, but all the game had gone down to winter in the foothills. Never saw so much as a rabbit. We was camped at Timberline in a stand of dead spruce, and come October's end, we was starving. One man run off. Horses died and froze. Circumstances was dire. The other man had the look of death about him already. I weren't far behind. There was enough snow melted we could have walked out if we just had a little strength. One morning, I took my shotgun, so weak I could hardly stand. Ways out from camp, I fired it into a tree. Started yelling I'd shot an elk. They come a-running, hooting and hollering. McClurg arrived first and I shot him. Nathan realized what was happening, what we had to do, but he didn't want no part of it. I was left with no choice but to kill him. I didn't cook your brother, though. McClurg was plumpest, leashed Gant up. I roasted his ass, had both sides. Got my strength up, stowed everything in an old bear den and broke camp next morning. Walked into a band 3 days later.
Billy stared at Otha, mouth agape, broken teeth showing, looking more than a little mystified.
You ate a man's backside? Weren't no face-licking Thanksgiving dinner. I was starving, Billy. And this don't concern you anyhow. Just thought the man deserved to know his brother's fate.
In the midst of a cloud, mist blowing past and a few stray flakes of snow, Ezekiel was overrun by a coldness that settled so deep inside him he knew he'd never be rid of it. He was dying, and he thought of Nathan dying, felt a strange connection to his brother in that moment. Wonder if he'd felt this alone in that moment before Otha murdered him. Ezekiel's respiration slowed. He tasted blood in his teeth, felt it trickling from the corner of his mouth. He had a terrible thirst, and he trembled with cold as he looked up at Otha.
Don't stare at me that way, Otha warned. Like you're looking at some kind of damned deviant. You lost your brother. I lost all three of mine to Federals at Malvern Hill. You didn't have to sit there with Nathan telling him about home when he's near cut in half, everything pouring out of him. Sight like that gets stamped on your mind. You can fucking forget about ever getting shed of it.
But Ezekiel had already descended back into the canyon. To his little cabin, to Gloria. He saw her in bed, felt her grief, and all the memories of Leadville and the boys and whatever selfish strain of freedom he'd associated with them, and had tasted today wilted into the sham they were. His lips moved, her name on them, and he loved her more, needed her more than he ever had. Thought of all the things he'd not said, wondered if she knew them anyway. Then reckoned not, because he hadn't known himself until this moment. He heard a deep, unsanded voice, fought to make his eyes open. When they did, the boulder field and mist and men and snow had faded to gray, and a darkness whose identity he well knew had whittled down his periphery of vision, so his whole world seemed to blacken around the edges like a winter-killed rose. Otho was only inches from his face now, his eyes such a pale and clouded blue some might have mistaken him for a blind man. It took Ezekiel a moment to comprehend the words.
"That man Billy shot, he killed?"
Ezekiel could only nod, utterly stove up.
"Who else knows about Bart?"
The darkness was closing in.
"Boy, you best find the strength to provide an answer."
"Just me and Doc. Just me and Doc," he whispered, his lips barely moving.
"How'd you know to find us here? Billy's wife? Bessie tell you?"
"Tracks.
Your tracks. Yours and the doctor's wife know about all this?"
Ezekiel shook his head.
"Yeah, that tastes of a lie."
"Gloria don't know."
"Well, I can tell you we damn sure ain't taking no chances on a couple of leaky-mouthed bitches feeding off their range."
"Gloria don't know a thing."
He's saying something, Otho."
"You let her be."
"Well, if he is, I can't hear it." "I bet Gloria knows. No telling who else she's told."
"We'll kill every man, woman, and child in the Bandon if that's what it comes to. You set to see this through, Billy?"
"Yes, Otho."
"Are you sure? I ain't gonna try to crawfish out of this."
"For a fact."
"Better go on and curl this one up then so we can sail away."
"Otho, he's almost dead, ain't he?"
"I don't give a good goddamn how almost dead he is. I ain't quitting this spot with that star toter still above Snakes. Savvy?"
Ezekiel heard his death sentence, felt the glimmer of relief, the pain beyond anything he'd known, like someone had thrown liquid silver in his guts. He watched Billy pour a 60-grain powder charge into one of the Colt's chambers, followed by a wad of paper. The boy used a small built-in ramrod to seat a lead ball. Ezekiel spent his last thought not on the horror of what might happen to Gloria, or his own inconceivable pain, or all the things he would not ever see or smell or taste again. He spent his last thought on his boy, the sound of Gus's laugh, what it had felt like to cradle him, the nape of his neck. With the boar charged, Billy set about fitting a brass cap to the nipple in the back of the cylinder.
"You was the best thing. You and your mama. And I wished I'd known that when I could have done something to preserve it."
Billy waded up to the rock where Ezekiel lay dying, leveled the 9-inch barrel between the man's eyes. Ezekiel barely heard the hammer thumb back because the possibility of heaven had dawned on him, and he was thinking how sweet and unexpected a surprise it would be to arrive there after all this, see Gus, sneak up on his boy, tickle his ribs, throw him in the air, and that laugh.
"Please, God, let me hear Gus laugh again if you're real and have any regard."
33.
O Lord God of my salvation, I have cried day and night before thee. Let my prayer come before thee.
The preacher lay shivering in a bank of snow at the base of the boulder field, so far beyond those innocuous, eloquent prayers he delivered to his congregation on Sunday mornings, beyond the decorum he'd always reserved for addressing his Savior. He could only manage a silent, desperate psalm.
"Incline thine ear unto my cry, for my soul is full of troubles."
In the distance, a horse snorted. Stephen raised his head, saw Otho Wallace and Billy McCabe loping through the powder on their mounts, leading a train of burros down from the pass.
"And my life draweth nigh unto the grave."
Stephen ducked under the bank and burrowed deep into the snow, taking the cape from his black great coat and draping it over his head to keep the powder from falling into his collar.
"I am counted with them that go down into the pit. I am as a man that hath no strength."
The preacher sat motionless and buried, his back to the snowbank, watching Russell Ilg's mare wandering between the boulders.
"Free among the dead,
like the slain that lie in the grave, whom thou rememberest no more, and they are cut off from thy hand.
He heard the tinkle and harness bells on the other side of the snowbank, no more than 10 feet from where he sat. Someone said,
"Whoa now."
He envisioned Billy and Otha tugging at their reins.
"Reckon these are Ezekiel's?"
Otha's voice. They were studying his tracks.
"Maybe that horse yonder."
"Thou hast laid in me the lowest pit, in darkness, in the deeps."
"Nah, that horse came from farther up. These here are the tracks of a man."
"Thy wrath lieth hard upon me, and thou hast afflicted me with all thy waves."
"I'll climb down and check it out if you want, Otha."
Stephen closed his eyes.
"Mine eye mourneth by reason of affliction. Lord, I have called daily upon thee. I have stretched out my hands unto thee."
"They was just the two of them, right?"
"Yeah, I think."
"Think? You little stuttering greener, you better—"
"They was just the two of them. I know it for a fact. And we saw the other one's body back there."
"Well, all right then. No, don't get down."
Otha clicked his tongue and the pack train moved on. When he could no longer hear the harness bells, Stephen staggered out of the drift and brushed the snow from the wool of his coat. He stood alone on the mountain, 100 feet below the pass, listening to the wind and the sound of it pushing grains of snow over the surface like sand skimming a beach. He thought of home in the South Carolina Low Country, and the memory of it filled him with heartsickness in this frozen desolation. Stephen found Russell's horse sheltering itself on the lee side of a giant boulder. He swung up into the saddle, quirted the horse on its snow-matted neck, rode upslope in the tracks of the pack train. At the saw blade, the wind blew steady and scaldingly cold. It had scoured out the snow and built a cornice on the north side, allowing Stephen to dismount onto bare rock. He followed the burrow tracks along an icy ledge. Despite the dizzying exposure, he couldn't stop himself from peering over. He saw a red crater 200 feet below. One of the burrows had lost its footing, gone over, exploded in the snow like a viscera bomb. The ledge ended at a recess in one of the jagged spires upthrust from the pass like a rotten canine tooth. He spotted an opening at knee level in the back wall, a small claim hole just wide enough for a man to crawl through. Stephen loosed the cloth buttons, reached into his coat. He thought he had a match in one of the pockets, but he didn't find it. He approached the hole. It went back 4 feet, then opened into darkness. He crawled in, wriggling himself through the tapering passageway, then finally emerged, the ground solid beneath his feet, though he had no sense of the chamber's dimensions. He extended his right foot. It struck something hard. He removed his gloves, squatted down, reached forward, his fingers grazing the cold gold, bars and bars and bars of it, stacked upon one another in a cube that rose above his knees. He lifted one of them, held it to the light that drizzled in through the hole, and as he stood in that semi-dark, staring down at the chunk of yellow metal, he considered the blood that had already been shed for it and wondered how much more was to come. He thought of all the people in that haunted town 2,000 feet below, how they'd endured this brutal wilderness and all its impositions, the cold, the thin air, the loneliness, maddening isolation, for just a fraction of what he held in his hand. And in that moment, he no longer regarded the residents of Abandon and the 1,000 other mining camps scattered like bacteria through the West as people of ambition and courage. They were a cold, dirty, desperate, miserable lot. He saw them now so clearly. They had crossed the plains and made homes in these savage mountains and borne their myriad afflictions not because they were brave pioneers pursuing a dream. They had come for no other reason but that their ravenous hearts raged with greed. The preacher crumpled down in the cave and wept. "Stephen." At the sound of his name, he went rigid with fear. 34. Stephen crawled out of the cave and walked back up to the pass. Above him, the clouds had broken up, beams of afternoon sunlight passing through, bronzing random patches of forest, summits, ice fields with the strongest light he'd seen in days. The mare stood waiting for him on the windswept rock. As he reached her and put his foot into the stirrup, he heard it, though owing to the wind, he couldn't immediately determine from which direction the sound had come. He looked downslope, and with the mist clearing, he could see all the way into the canyon and a line of specks near the Godsend mine. Otha and Billy and the burros on their way back to Abandon. He heard it again, a faint howl. Others joined in, each of varying pitch and duration, like a discordant symphony of owls and geese and baying dogs. Stephen pulled his foot out of the stirrup and walked to the other side of the pass, stood bracing against the wind, shielding his face with his gloves. At first there was little to see. Clouds sailed toward him and over him. Mammoth schooners. Fog swirling in the depths below, hiding the long, broadening valley, the lake several miles south, the open country beyond. He'd taken this trail to Silverton once before, much faster than the wagon road, though more dangerous because it required a steep descent along a series of narrow ledges that switchbacked down from the cirque. Now he gazed at those ledges, observed that the wind had blown them clean of snow, traced their dwindling switchbacks with his finger for several hundred feet until it passed over something that, from his vantage on the pass, resembled a trail of black ants ascending out of the fog. He stood bewildered, listening to the alien howls until another sound became prevalent, unshod horses pounding the rock. Out of sheer amazement, he stepped forward and squinted down at what looked to be an entire town on horseback. Women in print dresses, suit-coated men, some still wearing their filthy work clothes, and a hatless blonde leading the procession, poorly dressed for the conditions in a bright gold evening gown. As they drew near, he puzzled at their horses' hides, decorated with pagan hieroglyphs depicting wolves, bear, coyote, elk, eagles, trees, cacti, mountains, clouds, the arc of rivers. And as the riders rounded another switchback, facing him now, he saw that the woman in front wore the painted face of a heathen, and the gold gown was drenched in blood, the original owner's entire scalp having been stitched into the warrior's tonsured head, the curly yellow hair still pinned up in the fashion of the day, and around that heathen's waist hung a belt of sunburned noses as he appeared to be smiling, his blood-stained teeth filed down into razor points, and his horse's mane interwoven with the hair of numerous scalps still warm, still dripping, and those behind him equally outlandish, one rider naked save for a cape and bowler, another so caked with blood that he seemed to be rusting, one in nothing but a blue bonnet, one in a shredded corset beaded with eyes, and they bore weaponry of every design and from across the ages, shotgun, rifle, revolver, knife, lance, bow, sword. Some holding rocks still smeared with blood and brain, others wielding sharpened human femurs, one gripping a crude mace constructed of oak and leather and shards of quartz. And this parade of demons cackled and groaned, conversing in a strange, unholy tongue that sounded like some ancient form of necromancy.
"God Almighty," said the preacher.
The trail they climbed had no destination but Abandon. 2009. 35. Abigail thought she'd broken her back, but then she managed to lift her head and suck in a breath of air, realized she'd only had the wind knocked out of her. She lay on the stairs on her back, wood creaking all around her, threatening to give. Somewhere above, a man groaned. Dust and snow clouded her headlamp's triangle of light. Someone said her name. She looked down at her father sprawled a few steps below.
"You okay?"
he whispered. She nodded. June wept above them, and Abigail couldn't determine if the source was grief or pain. She glanced up, saw she'd landed just below the cupola, her headlamp shining into the library, spotlighting the pale, terrified face of June, the woman clutching a bookshelf and standing on the only ribbon of flooring still attached to the struts. With the sky exposed, snow fell into the stairwell column of Emerald House. Abigail lay midway down the third flight of steps. There was a sudden crack, and she watched something break through the ceiling, her light catching on a flash of blue ski jacket streaking past. Realized it was Emmett, his body dropping through darkness, crashing into the second flight of stairs, nearly hitting Jared, punching a hole through the steps, the second floor, finally slamming into the ground level as June screamed out from the library. Stu yelled, "Quit moving! You're gonna break this section of floor too!" Abigail shone her light down and across to the next flight of stairs, where Jared and Isaiah clung to the middle section, the top half having been severed from the third floor by Emmett's fall. Lawrence snapped his fingers. Abigail saw him motioning for her to climb down to him. She descended carefully, and as she neared him, he reached up, turned off her headlamp. His mouth pressed against her ear. He whispered,
"We're leaving. Step where I step and keep quiet."
Lawrence stood slowly. The step he occupied creaked. As he and Abigail moved down toward the third floor, Isaiah's voice rose up from below.
"Stu, where you at?"
"Up here in the library."
"You hurt?"
"Fucking ribs are killing me. You?"
"Me and Jared are scraped up, but we'll live. The other two with you?"
"No."
"Larry."
Isaiah purred his name as a beam of light swung through the debris onto the stretch of stairs where Abigail and her father had landed.
"I'm not seeing you in the cute, bitch."
A red dot appeared on the third flight of steps.
"Sound off, motherfucker."
Abigail could see the bright bulb of Isaiah's headlamp a few feet away. With the upper portion of the second flight of stairs destroyed, there was no way that he or Jared could reach the third floor, but they could sure as hell see them and shoot. He had only to turn around. Lawrence grabbed his daughter's hand, whispered in her ear,
"Follow me."
They crept around the stairwell toward the west wing, just a narrow corridor of gray, rotting wood that seemed to joggle with the motion of Lawrence's headlamp. The hall lined with doors, some closed, some ajar, most having rusted out of their hinges and toppled over onto the floor. 15 feet in, Lawrence stepped on a floorboard that squeaked. They froze, as if to retract the sound. Lawrence switching off his headlamp.
"That you, Lair?"
Abigail felt blind. Thought of all the scary movies she'd seen, horror novels she'd read. Realized nothing even approached this level of fear. She could have dreamed no better nightmare.
"Tell you what," Isaiah continued. "You do the smart thing, come on back, all'll be forgiven. But you run, better not ever let me catch your ass."
Movement on the second flight of stairs.
"He's coming," Abigail whispered. "But he can't reach us from those steps."
She heard a noise, glanced back. It sounded like quiet micro-explosions shredding the floor and the ceiling.
"What is that?"
she asked.
"Is this wing about to collapse?"
The little explosions moved closer, one here, two there. When Lawrence flicked on his headlamp and shone it on the floor, they both saw it pockmarked with tiny holes.
"Shit," he whispered. "He's underneath us, shooting up through the floor."
They ran, surrounded by the muffled thunk of rounds passing through the floor and ceiling, decayed wood raining down, the jingle of shell casings dropping on the second floor like handfuls of pocket change, then a pause, followed by an intense 30-round burst just ahead. Lawrence pulled Abigail through a doorless doorway, pushed her against the wall, the room small, part of the servants' quarters, boasting only a ruined bed and a wardrobe.
"There's a stairwell at the end of this wing," Lawrence said. "We're gonna take it." "But they're right underneath us." "And getting ready to find out that the end of the second floor's west wing is rotted out. They'll have to go back to the main stairwell. That's the only way down for them."
After another fury of machine pistol fire, Lawrence said,
"He's reloading. Let's go."
Abigail followed him back into the corridor, their footfalls noisy on the old wood. She heard someone yell, "Fuck!" and wondered if Isaiah had reached the caved-in portion of the second floor. Up ahead, the wing terminated into a sitting area. Crumbling furniture and overturned bookshelves grouped around a hearth. Above it all, a chandelier drooped from the ceiling, and through the broken windows, snow streamed in sideways. 4 strides from the sitting area, Abigail's right foot went through.
"Lawrence!"
she screamed, up to her elbows, both legs sticking out of the second floor ceiling. He sprinted back as the wood under her elbows broke. She dropped, but he had a solid grip around her wrists. Abigail looked down past her dangling feet, her headlamp jolted on, shining through a giant hole. The floor cracked under Lawrence's knees.
"I'm about to go through,"
he grunted, straining to lift her. The machine pistol at work again, ripping through the wood behind Abigail.
"Hurry,"
she whispered. During a brief reloading silence, Lawrence pulled her up, and they rolled into the sitting area as a slew of bullets eviscerated the spot where Abigail had punched through. They scrambled to their feet, tracking through blown-in snow.
"It's over here,"
Lawrence whispered, leading her to the northeast corner of the sitting area.
"I don't think he can get a clear shot at us in the stairwell."
"Is it safe?"
"Don't know."
Lawrence took the stairs two at a time. They descended through the second floor, finally emerging onto the ground level, their headlamps blazing through a kitchen replete with giant wash basins, two fireplaces, a brick oven, a clay oven, and numerous cabinets, all surrounding a long butcher block island. The windows had held their glass, so there was no snow or wind, only silence.
"Kill your headlamp,"
Lawrence whispered. They both went dark. Without the aid of light, Abigail couldn't even see her father standing a foot in front of her.
"This is good,"
he said, leading Abigail forward.
"We'd see their light if they were coming down the main staircase."
She heard a doorknob turn, hinges grinding.
"It's pitch black. How can you see anything at all?"
"I know this mansion very..."
Lawrence stopped.
"What is it?"
"I heard something up ahead."
"What?"
"Wood cracking under a footstep."
A long moment of silence elapsed, then Abigail saw the sole point of light in all that smothering darkness. She said,
"Oh God."
And Lawrence looked down at his chest, touched the red dot moving in tiny circles around the North Face logo on his parka. They lunged back into the kitchen as glass fell out of the French doors and rear window. Abigail never heard the shot. Lawrence's headlamp lighted up. He pulled Abigail toward the wash basins between the ovens, helped her climb onto the counter, footsteps pounding toward them.
"What do I do?"
she asked. He pushed her through. Abigail fell outside into the snow. As Lawrence climbed through the windowsill, the French doors burst open, headlamp beam sweeping in a frenzy of movement over the walls of the kitchen.
"Come on!"
she screamed, but they dragged her father back into Emerald House.
36. Abigail felt hands seize her, pull her back into the kitchen, jags of glass on the windowsill slicing through Gore-Tex, fleece, thermal underwear, skin, blood running down her left leg as she slammed into the rotting floor. Her headlamp passed over Jared and Isaiah, each man holding night vision goggles, the barrels of their machine pistols steaming in the cold. Isaiah's foot swung through the dark and she heard the breath rush out of Lawrence as he doubled over on the floor. Isaiah knelt before Abigail, slid the knife out of his ankle sheath.
"No,"
Lawrence hissed, still struggling to breathe. Abigail tried to get up. Then she lay on her back, the left side of her jaw throbbing and burning. Isaiah sitting on top of her, pinning her shoulders down with the heels of his boots. He unzipped her fleece jacket and pulled her thermal underwear out of her waistband, exposing her bare stomach, rigid like a washboard and heaving in the dark.
"Hold his head, Jared. You watching, Lair? I'm gonna cut a hole right here."
He tapped Abigail's belly button with the knife point.
"And reach in, start yanking stuff out."
When the blade touched her stomach, she went to another place, without sound or feeling. She imagined a Long Island beach, middle of summer. Isaiah's headlamp became the gentle sun. Her father's voice brought her back.
"I lied,"
Lawrence gasped.
"I lied to you, Isaiah."
Isaiah still pushed the knife. Abigail sucking in her gut, pressure and pain beginning to build.
"Hear what he's saying?
I got ears, Jared."
"The gold isn't here,"
Lawrence rasped.
"I'll help you find it. I swear, just leave her."
Isaiah suddenly sheathed the knife, stood up, left Abigail shaking on the floor. He lifted Lawrence and slammed him into the oven, the professor's feet off the floor.
"What would you have done?"
Lawrence said.
"You spend years trying to find something, then someone sweeps in last second to steal it all from you. I couldn't..."
Isaiah rammed him into the brick again, dust showering down from the ceiling.
"Your ass better stop making sense in a fucking hurry." "That secret room in Bart's wing is where the gold was kept, until Christmas 1893. For a long time I was sure the bars were in Emerald House. I searched every room, even scoured the south wing rubble. I'd given up when I found Gloria Curtis's diary. Something big was going down on Christmas in Abandon. She wrote that two men, Otha Wallace and Billy McCabe, had murdered Bart Packer and his servants and made off with a load of gold. Apparently her husband and some other men rode up toward the mine in pursuit. So fucking what? So, when you're in a tiny town, dead of winter, and you've just stolen 2,000 pounds of gold, you have to hide it. Look in my eyes, Larry, and you better have an answer to this. Where's the gold now? I haven't found it yet. Isaiah simply dropped him, slipped a clip out of his belt, popped it into the Glock, and racked the slide. No, listen. Otha and Billy had already been prospecting together. They had this claim up at Sawblade Pass. Gloria mentions it in her diary because Billy's wife had blabbed her about it. It would make perfect sense. They stashed the gold up there, and first chance they get, it's a straight shot down the mountain into Silverton. They're home free and set for life. Then it's gone, right? They would have taken it. Would have, yes, except, remember, every resident of Abandon disappeared on Christmas Day, so they probably never got the chance. You telling me the gold's up at the pass? I'm telling you, I think that's where it is, but I haven't had a chance to explore up there since finding Gloria's diary. Scott and I had planned to do that during this trip. Isaiah paced around the butcher block island. Isaiah? Thinking, Jared. 3 more trips around the island, then Isaiah stopped and looked at his partner. Go help Stu and that woman down from the library, and get them set up in the foyer. As Jared disappeared into the west wing stairwell, Isaiah walked over to Abigail and her father, now huddled together at the base of the brick oven. You know where this old claim hole is or not, Larry? I think, motherfucker, let me hear the word think come out of your mouth one more. I can find it. I know where to look, and I'll take you up there at first light when... First light? Tomorrow? Isaiah laughed, then reached out, caressed Abigail's face with the back of his hand. I don't think you grasp the situation, Lair. This is your daughter, right? Well, know this. If I don't have these gold bars in my possession before first light, you're gonna watch me do terrible things to your little girl before I go to work on you. 37. The storm wound up into such a flood of snow they lost sight of Emerald House just 50 yards out from the portico, Stu and June staying behind in the mansion's foyer. Within the hour, Isaiah, Jared, Lawrence, and Abigail had reached the mine, the professor leading them beyond the snow-blasted remnants of the mill to the canyon's end, where they started the long, steep climb to the pass. Jared had roped Abigail to her father in an effort to impede an easy escape, and she was trying not to cry in the face of the surreal horror of it all. The throbbing gash above her left eye, the blood sliding down her leg from that deep cut on the back of her thigh, when a crushing realization sunk in. We're going to die in these mountains. She could find no reason to believe these men would ever let them live. Worst case scenario, they don't find the gold bars and we die horribly. Best case, they find the gold and we die quickly. Is that what I have to hope for? A bullet in the back of my head? Lawrence put his arm around her. She shoved it away. 500 feet up, they stopped to rest, sitting in 6 inches of powder on a rock outcropping. Abigail between her father and Isaiah, watching the snowflakes swarm in the beam of her headlamp, all 4 of them practically panting in the thin air. In a lull between wind gusts, Lawrence looked over at Jared, said, So, Scott told you what we were looking for up here. Was he going to cut you in, but you double-crossed him? Is that the deal? As Jared passed a water bottle down the line, he shook his head. Month ago, I left Hinterlands Incorporated for the day, got to my Bronco, and realized I'd forgotten my keys. When I came back in, Scott was on the phone, feet propped on his desk, talking to you about the logistics of transporting a ton of gold through 17 miles of wilderness. It got my attention. So all of this, 2 people dead because you forgot your keys? Ain't life some shit, Isaiah said. Tell me, Larry, I did some research on this ghost town before I came out here, but since you the professor, what the fuck happened? I don't know. But you got a theory or something? Yeah. So share that shit. No, I don't. I ain't asking. What you think wiped out this town? Lawrence hesitated, said, I figured an act of God. You mean something supernatural? No. I mean, I thought God wiped them out, like Sodom and Gomorrah, fire and brimstone raining from the sky, the angel of darkness. Nothing else made sense. That's cold. Yeah, well, but I like it. Read the Old Testament. Back in the day, God used to do that shit all the time. Abigail took her drink of water, glancing at Isaiah.
Keep him talking. Make a connection beyond victim-captor. If you don't humanize yourself, you're dead.
Could I ask you something, Isaiah? She said.
Sure. We can friend up for a little while. You know, I'm actually a great guy. You met me under any other circumstance, you probably love my ass.
Strangely enough, she believed him. Imagined meeting him at her local gym, developing a flirtatious banter on neighboring rowing machines.
Were you and your partners in Iraq together?
Isaiah swiped the water bottle out of her hand, took a drink, wiped his mouth.
Force Recon.
Desert Storm or
Iraqi Freedom?
I just wondered because on the hike in, I noticed Jared has post-traumatic stress.
We all got that shit.
Jared turned, and she could see his eyes narrowed under the bulb of his headlamp, considered the possibility that she'd misread him, that he might be capable of killing her.
Why would you talk to her about that? Chill out, my man.
You saw combat? Abigail asked.
Christ, Isaiah, tell her to shut the...
Don't shut down on me, she thought.
Yeah, we got into some shit.
What happened?
Our unit slipped into southern Iraq in the weeks leading up to the major offensive.
Eyes, not fucking around here. What are you...
Jared, my therapist says it's healthy to talk about it. Bad for you to hold this shit in.
You're crazy. Jared got up and walked away.
The Navy had bombed the hell out of a Republican Guard division about 125 miles southeast of Baghdad in the city of Kut. We were sent in a day later with the objective of confirming that no enemy combatants or artillery had survived the attack, greasing the skids for the invasion. Our CH-46 set down on this ridge just before dawn. And soon as we touched ground, we started taking heavy mortar and machine gun fire. As the chopper was lifting off, an RPG hit it. Boom! Game over. It's me and five men versus 50 Republican Guard soldiers. We're pinned down. Majorly fucked. Half our units killed in the first 3 minutes. Me, Jared, and Stu surrendered. And that's when the shit went down. Woke up chained to a chair in a room without windows, and with concrete walls so purple, they looked like they'd been primed with blood. These two interrogators went to work on us for the next week. I could hear Jared and Stu screaming in the adjacent rooms. That was the worst part. Listening to them, knowing what was coming.
Abigail touched his arm, looked into his brown eyes.
Keep him talking. What did they do to you, Isaiah?
He smiled.
Oh, lots of things. Those were some ingenious motherfuckers. They had this metal cot wired to a couple car batteries. That was loads of fun. You noticed the scars on Jared's face? Did that with acid. My stomach looks like someone glued a bunch of spaghetti to it. They don't tell you when you sign up for the Marines that you might get gangbanged by a bunch of towelheads. I told them everything I knew, spilled all my secrets, even made up some shit they wanted to hear. They were on the verge of flaying us when the good guys showed up. Team of Rangers got us out of there.
Abigail stared up at him, his face surprisingly calm and expressionless in the glare of her light.
I'm sorry that happened to you, she said. But I guess what doesn't kill you...
What don't kill you makes you a mean-ass motherfucker.
Can I tell you something, Isaiah?
What?
It's nothing like what you experienced, but I'm afraid right now. Afraid when you get this gold you're gonna kill me, because I've seen your face and know something about you. Will you tell me if that's what's going to happen, so I can at least begin to prepare for it?
Jared returned, said, Think we could end the therapy session, get the fuck up this mountain?
Hey, I needed to do this. Sherry says I don't talk enough about it, so I'm practicing. You should unload, brother, shit's empowering.
You ain't right, man. Isaiah grinned at Abigail.
Don't think Jared ain't holding his shit together. He's doing okay. Our man Stu, on the other hand, sad, sad motherfucker. Just fell apart. Wife left him when he came back. Took his little girl. He lost everything. How many times he tried to kill himself, Jer?
3.
And, as you probably gathered, he's a raging alky. I know this gold ain't a cure-all, and we still gonna be fucked up the rest of our lives, but don't we deserve a little compensation after all we've been through? Ain't like Uncle Sam could give a fuck.
Can we go now? You need a hug first?
Isaiah chuckled, shot Jared the bird. Yeah, let's hit it.
Never answered my question, she thought.
Before Abigail stood, she noticed something at her feet, reached down, lifted the light, brittle skull out of the snow. She shone her headlamp onto the brain case of some animal, a horse perhaps, browned and cracking, filled with bits of rock and bone fragments that rattled inside like sand in a seashell. And she imagined some carefree hiker, a half century from now, holding her sun-bleached skull in his hands, speculating with his companions about her fate. 38. Lawrence and Abigail stood at 13,000 feet, already a foot of snow at the pass and the wind screaming beyond comprehension, so hard that they could lean into it at 45-degree angles and be held upright. They watched their captors trudge upslope, wearing those acrylic black masks again to shield their faces from the stinging cold. Lawrence waved them over and shouted above the wind,
I want to explore this side first. There's a recess in the cliff that looks very interesting.
Isaiah gave a thumbs up, and they worked their way over from the saddle to the base of the palisade, a series of broken crags that, from abandon, resembled an old saw blade cutting at the sky. When she saw where he was leading them, Abigail grabbed hold of her father's arm. Accessible from the pass, a ledge traversed the escarpment. To her right, vertical snow-glazed rock that lifted beyond the range of her headlamp. To her left, a stomach-churning drop into darkness. She shone her light over the edge and watched snowflakes swirling and tumbling down through the beam, losing sight of them long before they reached the bottom. Near the pass, the ledge was 4 feet wide, broad enough for Abigail and Lawrence to walk abreast. But it narrowed as it crossed the face of the palisade, and Abigail had to follow behind her father, hugging the cliff as with each step she punched through a foot of fresh powder. The ledge went on and on. It narrowed to 3 feet, then 2. Toward the end, the ledge sloped down just enough so that Abigail's boots would slide over the icy rock toward the edge if she lingered in one spot too long. Suddenly, Lawrence turned and pulled her underneath an overhang, out of the snow, out of the wind, the rock dry. Abigail's face had gone numb, and she took off her gloves, pressed her palms into her cheeks.
Listen, Abby, Lawrence whispered. I'm gonna try to.
Isaiah and Jared emerged from the ledge and ducked into the overhang. They collapsed onto the rock, their black parkas blanched with snow.
This it, Larry?
This is the place I wanted to check out, yeah.
Don't look like much to me. You ain't fucking around again.
How about that? Does that look like something?
Isaiah aimed his headlamp at the back wall. The corners of his mouth lifted, his bright, perfect teeth shining their malevolent smile.
Now that does look like some shit.
Isaiah got up, walked over to the opening in the rock. He squatted down, peered inside.
How far's it go back? Jared asked.
About 4 feet.
Can you see anything?
Nah, this tunnel slants down and to the left.
He put his light on Lawrence.
You been in here before, Lair?
No. I'd planned to come up here on some downtime during our 3 days in abandon.
Isaiah pushed back his hood and pulled off his face mask. From underneath the overhang, the wind sounded like a fleet of jet engines as it tore across the pass.
See, part of me's thinking that you might be a conniving motherfucker. You feel me?
No, I don't feel you.
You're telling me that's an old claim hole?
Far as I know.
Well, I'm all for sending your ass in first, but what if it's, in fact, a cave, and you just disappear once you get inside? Only one of us can fit through the tunnel at a time.
Look, I have no idea what's in there, Lawrence said. I hope for our sake it's a shitload of gold. Based on my research, everything I know about Otha and Billy, I have a feeling that's exactly what we're going to find. But I'm not leaving Abigail, so you don't have to...
All right, tell you what. We'll send Abigail in.
Jared, undo Larry's end of the rope and whip up one of your fancy knots for the lady.
It took Jared less than a minute to untie Lawrence and prepare a harness for Abigail.
Second time you've done this, she said as he ran the rope around her thighs. Remember yesterday?
He'd taken off his mask, and when he looked up, her headlamp shone on the crescent moon scars that ruined his face. In spite of everything, she found it impossible not to feel a flicker of compassion for what he'd endured in Iraq.
"She's ready," he said. Abigail approached the opening and shone her headlamp inside.
"What's the story on there being bad air in there?"
she asked.
"Guess you'll let us know, huh?"
She climbed in and wormed her way through the hole, arriving after 10 seconds in a small chamber roughly the size of her studio, but with a much lower ceiling, just barely over 6 feet. Isaiah crawled through the passage now, and she moved away from the opening as he stepped down into the chamber.
"Get your ass in here, Larry."
They shone their headlamps over the bare, rocky floor, across the walls, the low, jagged ceiling. Isaiah walked the circumference of the room, returning to the opening of the tunnel just as Lawrence emerged. He grabbed the professor by the scruff of his yellow parka and dragged him out into the chamber.
"Fuck," Lawrence said. "Fuck is right. What the fuck, Larry?"
Lawrence struggled to his feet. He walked to the farthest corner and squatted down, carefully lifting the only man-made object in the chamber.
"What you got?"
Lawrence held up the scraps of an old burlap sack.
"This is what the gold was carried in. Probably used a team of burros to bring it to the pass." "So what's the good news? There a secret passage? I push one of these rocks and the treasure room opens up?"
"Larry, I know you got some silver lining for me."
As Lawrence stood up and looked over at Isaiah, Abigail saw something in her father's eyes she'd not seen until now. Fear, bewilderment, a hint of real desperation.
"This is where they brought the gold, I'm sure of it. It was stored right here on Christmas Day in 1893. Now it's gone. So they must have come back and taken off with it after they'd murdered most of the townspeople. I feel more strongly than ever that it was Otha and Billy who somehow wiped out Abandon in an unprecedented act of mass..."
"See, I don't give a fuck about all that."
"What else do you want from me? At this point, I've done everything I can."
Isaiah closed the distance between himself and Lawrence.
"I'm not jerking you off here, Isaiah. I could lead you on some wild goose chase all night long. Oh, I think it's here. Well, maybe they hid it there. Okay, one more place to look. I'm not doing that. This is the honest, stone-cold truth. Now that I know it's not here, I don't have the first fucking clue where the gold is. May not even be in the San Juans."
Isaiah just stared at him, and Abigail could sense the internal debate going on behind his chocolate eyes, knew their fate was being decided, thought how Isaiah's silence was so much more horrifying than his noisy stream of threats. He knelt down slowly, deliberately lifted the right pant leg of his waterproof trousers. Lawrence was trembling now, his hands behind his back.
"He left his gun outside with Jared, but not the knife. He's going to kill my father. Then murder me. What a perfect place to leave our bodies."
Isaiah unsnapped the ankle sheath, and as he grasped the knife, Lawrence's right arm swung out in a wide arc that ended in a muffled cracking collision with the side of Isaiah's head. Isaiah groaned, fell over unconscious. Lawrence, staring at the fist-sized rock still gripped in his hand, half stunned, as if in disbelief that his arm had done this thing. 39. Lawrence knelt down and unclipped the sheath from Isaiah's ankle. He cut the rope that linked Abigail's harness to the overhang, and as he slid the sheathed knife into his pocket, Abigail ran her hands up and down Isaiah's legs, his arms, and around his waist before suddenly stopping. She unzipped his parka, reached into an inner pocket, and plucked out an olive-colored ball the size of an apple and weighing just under a pound. A band of yellow nomenclature ran across the equator of the steel sphere. Grenade. Hand. Frag. Delay. M67. Comp B. She looked up at her father, their eyes going wide at the same time. She turned the grenade slowly in her hand, examining the safety pin, the lever.
"What's going on in there, Isaiah?" Jared shouted through the tunnel. "We happy?"
Abigail leaned forward, whispered,
"You ever handle one of these?"
He shook his head.
"You know how it works?"
Lawrence touched the safety pin.
"I know you pull this out, and as long as your hand is holding the lever down, I think it won't explode."
"You think? What's your knowledge based on?"
"You don't want to know."
"Tell me."
"Rambo." "Isaiah!" Jared shouted.
You're killing me, man.
Abigail said, Well, he's going to be coming through that hole momentarily. You want to try to fight him with the knife you just took?
He'd kill me.
Then we have to throw this grenade.
They walked over to the tunnel opening. Jared's headlamp illuminated the rock midway through from the other side.
Isaiah! He shouted. I'm coming in, all right?
No, Jared, Abigail said. We're on our way out.
Lawrence motioned for her to yank the pin.
You find the gold?
We didn't find it.
Abigail slipped her finger through the ring and pulled out the safety pin.
How long do we have? She whispered. Once I throw it, is it 5 seconds or 3?
I don't know.
Her hand had begun to shake, knuckles white from the death grip she had on the M67's striker lever. Lines of sweat trickling down her forehead and into her eyes. She blinked away the sting.
If it's 5 seconds, Jared might have time to throw it back in here at us, she said.
Isaiah! The fuck's going on? Everything cool?
Isaiah moaned again.
When I let go of this, Abigail said, we dive into that corner and cover our heads.
Make a good throw. We don't want it rolling back in here.
Isaiah, you okay?
Abigail realized she'd been holding her breath.
I'm coming in.
Abigail cocked her arm back and let the M67 fly. They lunged into the corner, Abigail's face crushed into the rocky floor. Lawrence sprawled on top of her. She shut her eyes, listening to the grenade ricochet off the rock as it bounced through the tunnel. She heard Jared say,
Shit.
2 seconds of silence, then the ground shook and shards of the ceiling fell down. Abigail said,
Lawrence, you okay?
Yeah, you?
My ears are ringing.
She sat up, turned on her headlamp. The chamber had filled with a haze of dust and smoke. They got to their feet, moved over to the tunnel.
I don't hear him, Lawrence whispered. Think he had time to throw it over the edge?
They heard something behind them and both turned, their headlamps spotlighting Isaiah, who was trying to sit up.
We have to go,
she said.
We'll shoot him with Jared's gun.
Abigail followed Lawrence back through the tunnel into the thickening smoke. As she came out under the overhang, she could see that her throw had been perfect. Her headlamp shone on the rock, blasted black from the detonation, steel fragments everywhere, under her feet, embedded in the stone. But no Jared and no blood.
Where is he?
Abigail whispered, the words hardly out of her mouth when Jared appeared around the corner from the narrow ledge, walking toward them unscathed, a red dot moving back and forth between their chests. Lawrence and Abigail backpedaling toward the far edge of the overhang, snow blowing in, squeezing out the residual smoke.
Isaiah!
Jared hollered at the opening in the rock.
Is he alive?
Before Abigail could answer, Isaiah's voice boomed back.
You got him?
Yeah.
Motherfucker clocked me with the rock!
Isaiah climbed out of the tunnel.
I almost ate shrapnel, Jared said.
Missing anything? You didn't hear your M67 go off?
I was out cold.
Yeah, I'm standing here hollering through the tunnel and you aren't answering. And just when I'm starting to think maybe something's not right, this grenade comes banging through, dropped right where you stand.
No shit.
I didn't know if it had been cooked off, so I didn't have time to throw it over the cliff.
What'd you do?
Hauled ass around the corner and prayed to God that skinny ledge wouldn't break up underneath me. Isaiah turned his attention to Lawrence and Abigail. He smiled, severe pain in his eyes.
Damn, Larry, cute bitch. You bad motherfuckers, you. Almost took out a couple of Marines. That would have been some shit. Ah, damn.
You all right? Jared asked. Isaiah bent over, shook his head as if to gauge the pain.
I think he fucked me up serious. Put your light here.
Jared inspected the side of his partner's head.
How's it look?
Nasty bruise. How's it feel?
Like a monster migraine?
You probably got a concussion.
Where's my Glock?
Jared lifted the nylon strap over his head, and Isaiah grabbed his machine pistol by its long magazine. Staggered toward them, wincing with each step.
Abby, Lawrence said, do exactly what I say right when I say it, no matter how crazy it sounds.
Lawrence took hold of his daughter's hand, the backs of their boots only inches from the edge, and Isaiah less than 5 feet away.
Jump.
40. Abigail raced feet first down a 40-degree slope. She'd lost her father's hand on impact, but she could hear him yelling at her from above.
Get on your stomach, Abby! Dig in! Stop yourself!
50 feet below, she saw where the slope ended and dropped over a cliff. Now she rolled onto her stomach, snow rushing under her parka in a spray of freezing powder. She kicked in her boots.
Your elbows!
Lawrence shouted. Abigail dug in her elbows, slowed to a halt, gasping, shivering. Glancing over her shoulder, she saw the cliff edge less than 5 feet beyond the soles of her boots. Felt a queasiness in her stomach. Her depth perception skewed by vertigo. Right leg badly quaking. The only appendage keeping her on the mountain. Upslope, Lawrence's headlamp shone down on her.
Climb back to me, he yelled. Make sure you've got purchase with each step.
Her face ached with cold. She wiped away the powder and started to climb toward her father, taking her time, kicking steps in the smooth old ice under the new fallen snow. As the adrenaline rush waned, her tailbone began to throb. Lawrence reached down, grabbed her hand, pulled her up onto a boulder.
You in one piece?
He asked. His pack lay open in the snow and he was cinching the last strap of a crampon onto his boot.
My tailbone kills. It's cracked, or worse. I busted up my right ankle.
That was insane, Lawrence.
We were dead otherwise. I knew it was only a 30-foot fall. I just crossed my fingers and hoped the slope was steep enough and had enough snow to cushion our landing.
Abigail peered up into the darkness, spotted 2 points of light somewhere above, obscured by the blizzard.
Turn off your headlamp, she whispered. I see their lights.
Voices tumbled down from the overhang, vague but audible. Snow's coming down too hard and my beam's weak. How many clips you got left?
2. Let's just spray the fuckers.
Lawrence whispered.
We gotta move right now. Follow me.
It was only 5 steps upslope to the base of the cliff. They reached it, flattened themselves against the wall of rock, and waited. From above came the sound of slides racking. Then the machine pistols murmured. Abigail could hear the bullets striking ice and rock a few yards downslope. It went on for some time, random bursts across the slope, one of which came within 2 feet of the cliff base where they hid. It finally stopped. Everything quiet save the wind. Jared's voice.
Well, that was a waste of ammo.
Isaiah.
How you feeling, Jared? Strong and big bald?
What are you talking about?
Your ass better be right behind me.
Something crashed into the snow 30 feet downslope.
God damn!
Isaiah screamed. Jared landed several feet beyond, shouted,
Fuck, I can't stop!
Jared, try to...
Fuck!
Stick your knife in the snow.
I can't reach.
There was a long, fading scream. Lawrence began to climb down, Abigail following close behind. They reached the boulder, turned on their headlamps. 20 feet below, Isaiah clung to the slope's steepest pitch, struggling to find an edge on the ice.
Wait here, Lawrence whispered.
No, I'm coming with you.
Lawrence tapped his boot.
I've got crampons, you don't. Want to end up like Jared?
Abigail watched her father work his way down.
This is the end of disc number 4. Please insert disc number 5.